Welcome to Personal Landscapes. I'm your host, Ryan Murdoch. You can find links for today's episode and other conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdoch.com. I first got interested in the Wakan Corridor when I read The Great Game by Peter Hopkirk. It's that strange finger of territory projecting off northeastern Afghanistan into the Pamir, Hindu Kush, and Karakoram Mountains. This weird bit of political geography once formed a buffer between Tsarist Russia and Imperial Britain. It's been closed to traffic for more than a century, and it remains one of the world's least visited corners. Today I'm speaking with someone who went there. Bill Colgrave is the author of Halfway House to Heaven, an account of his journey to find the source of the Oxus River. He also compiled Scraps of Wool, an anthology of some of the world's greatest travel writing, and he was the owner and publisher of Cadogan Guides. We spoke about The Great Game, the Wakan Corridor, and the challenges of traveling to such a remote place. What first sparked your interest in the Oxus River?
Came from maybe when I was about 15 or 16. I was at school and I was asked into the history master's office, and I'd clearly done something wrong. So while waiting for him, I pulled a book out of the shelves, which I thought was Tom Brown's School Days, or written by the guy who wrote Tom Brown's School Days. And it turned out to be a book of poems by Matthew Arnold. And I started to read the remarkable story of Saurabh and Rustum. And eventually I took it away and read the whole poem. And it's such an appealing, romantic, epic poem that it just stayed with me forever. And it's the story of the father and son across on different sides of the Oxus. And it's a story that has brought many people to hear about the river, and indeed is quoted by almost everybody who starts a book on that area. Lord Curzon, when he wrote his celebrated book, which I was really following up the Wakan, he quotes it on page one. Peter Hopkirk is quoting it as well. And it became the Oxus River became a sort of a destination which few people ever went to, but excited people in their personal landscape terms, as I would say, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. These places whose name alone takes on this resonance for travelers, and so. But a lot of the time with those places, whose names take on great resonance, when you get to them, you find that it's a bit of a letdown. Like Mandalay was just kind of a dusty, hot, miserably hot place, or you know, a Timbuktu, or these places. So was the Oxus one of those places, or did it live up to this mystique?
I still want to go to Timbuktu. And of course, Matthew Arnold had never been near the Oxus and had no idea what it was like. But absolutely, it certainly did live up to. I mean, the exciting thing about the Oxus, it's a river that is sort of a river in reverse. It starts with a bang and ends with a whimper because it never gets to the sea. And it's a real dividing line, a continental dividing line, like there isn't really... Well, maybe the Himalayas are, but that's a dividing line between the bits of Asia that were more known, India, Afghanistan, and the bits of Asia that somehow weren't, Transoxiana, the bits that we used to call the soft underbelly of Russia. And it is a real dividing line.
You should say where it is, first of all, for those who don't know, and give a sense of that historical significance.
So the Oxus or the... Panj, or Amu Darya, as it's now called, starts in the Pamir Mountains, which divide North Pakistan from Tajikistan. And they're in that little tongue of Afghanistan, which sticks out like a forefinger from its eastern end. And it's a narrow strip of land, which is a buffer between what was the old Tsarist Russian Empire and what was India and British India, and it's a buffer through which people were not meant to travel. And it's a sort of cul-de-sac, so that as you go up it, it comes to an end. So people tend to go, if you go up there, you've got to come back again. You can't go on. And the Oxus then flows out of the mountains, and it becomes the border between Afghanistan and Tajikistan, and then Afghanistan and Uzbekistan for quite a long time. And then it flows north up through the western end of Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and eventually into the Kizilkum Desert. And it would have finished in the Great Aral Sea. But the depredations in the 1950s and 60s and 70s of water used for cotton cultivation in Uzbekistan basically drained it. And it now dies in the Kizilkum and never reaches the Aral Sea, which is, although recently it's been growing a bit, we hear, but actually it's down to about 20% of its level of 40 or 50 years ago.
I was surprised how small the river was towards that end as well. Like we were in Kiva in December, and I saw some old photos of the river, and even at Kiva, it was quite it wasn't as big as the St. Lawrence where I grew up, but it was a substantial sized river. And when we crossed it, north of Urgench to go out to the desert to find some ruined fortresses, it was just a braided trickle, even at that point. Just a kind of a broken up, very shallow, and you could see irrigation channels leading off of it everywhere. So just completely bled dry.
So it starts big. That was the idea of my journey, in a way, was to try and find where it started. And it does start bigger than most rivers. It's got it comes pouring out of the mountains in the Pamirs, but then it goes, it cuts a heavy defile through the mountains when it comes down and becomes the border between Uzbekistan and Afghanistan up to the corner. It turns westwards at a place called Roshan Vomar in Tajikistan, and it's still pretty big, but it's quite powerful there, so there's not a lot of transport backwards and forwards, other than a bit of heroin dealing. Then it spreads out, and as you saw, it dissipates itself eventually.
But this has always been a barrier between cultures, like the natural barrier between kind of the worlds of Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and the Central Asian lands to the north. So it separated the steppe lands from these settled societies like the Persians, the Bactrians, and those sorts of people.
Yes, and it is, if one thinks of the map, there is a very real barrier, because the Himalaya, all the way over from north of Assam, all the way across, then the Karakoram, and then the Hindu Kush, you've got a very, very long distance through which, in effect, there's no real travel. I mean, there are a few passes, as we know, but very little. So when, for example, the Mongols, the Moguls wanted to get into India, or anybody else wanted to get into India, or the Chinese, the only way you're really going to do it is to skirt all the way around and then come through places like the Khyber Pass, which is way down near Peshawar in Pakistan. And so that's their barrier, and that's why the Oxus, which is just north of that barrier, is a divider between two very different parts of Asia.
It's amazing too how many historical footprints crossed here as well. Like Alexander crossed the Oxus, Tamerlane crossed the Oxus. So many legendary kind of monumental historical figures. You can find their footsteps in this area.
Yes.
So it's quite inspiring for the traveler.
Alexander may, yes, he may have done. And he probably did reach the Oxus, but then turned down and crossed the Indus. Extraordinary. I mean, we think of Alexander as a huge part of that period of history, like the Greeks or the Romans, but actually he was only wandering around that part of the world for 9 years, then died. He's left he's left a big footprint, mainly, I think, from because he was, like so many people, they're remembered by the people they required to write their own history for them.
Another thing that strikes me as interesting about it is that it wasn't navigable. So it never served as a conduit for trade or access to places. The unnavigability made it not just a barrier, not very useful for facilitating travel up and down it.
No, you hardly ever see any boats. I met a guy who tried to go to what he thought of the source of the Oxus and go down by canoe. But even he did not succeed. He had to transport his canoe. It is not navigable at all easily, except for a small part in the up near Termez on the Afghan-Uzbek border, where there is a bridge. But there are very few bridges on the thing, apart from that one.
Was that just for political reasons?
There's no reason for a bridge in the upper reaches of the Oxus. There's one at Ishkashim, which is where I entered when going on this trip, where I entered Afghanistan. There's a bridge there from Tajikistan. After that, there are barriers to stop people trying to come across. The Russians had put that. So because the only trade there was, and probably still is, drugs trade going backwards and forwards, but otherwise there's not a lot of communication.
So you've described the Wakhan Corridor as a high altitude cul-de-sac on the very outer limits of geography, a place less traveled by outsiders than the moon. Well, you touched on it a few moments ago, but where did this strange bit of political geography come from? Like, why is Afghanistan a big blob of a country with this little bit sticking off the end, this strange little bit?
In the 19th century, the political issue was whether or not the Russians would try to invade rich India. The British, who controlled a lot of India at the time, claimed to be very frightened of this. I think that it was highly unlikely they ever would, because the distance between Russian centres of population and India were huge, and the opportunities for taking over India were very small. However, this sort of, the idea was they created a sort of barrier. Now the Wakhan corridor consists substantially of a thing called the Little Pamir. Now, Pamirs are high altitude plains, and we're all very used to going into mountains, and between the peaks you've got V-shaped valleys. However, in the Pamirs, for various geological reasons, the V-shaped valleys caused by erosion streams have never really moved the rubble out to create the V-shape, and you still have these high-altitude plains, which is what a Pamir is. Very good for people like me that are frightened of they get acrophobia being on too high and exposed a place. So you climb up high and suddenly you're in an open plain.
And now, are they grassy as well? I mean, they're...
And grassy. Well, grass and wild thyme was what I found a lot of. So the Pamirs are up at about 3,000 or 4,000 meters of, and once you get up there, you're in Jack in the Beanstalk land. And so the main part of the Wakhan corridor is this Little Pamir, which runs parallel to North Pakistan and Tajikistan, and was taken as the buffer between the two. There was a Durand line created in about 1896, which said this is the division between the Russias, the Tsarist areas, and the Southern Asian Indian, what is now Pakistan area. And it was very suitable because almost nobody was there. In the winter, nobody at all. And in the summer, there are Vaki tribesmen that come down from Tajikistan mainly, and put some of their sheep there.
So we should also mention the Great Game, since basically that's what we're describing, this conflict between Russia and Britain. And this is something that both of us are big readers of, I think, and found quite fascinating and motivating to go to that part of the world. So what is the Great Game?
I think there are only two moments when in what we call the Great Game, and the Great Game basically being what the Russians, I think, call the Tournament of Shadows. And it's the standoff between what was the British Empire and British India and the Tsarist Empire, standoff between them as to whether or not they're ever going to get into conflict in the area. And they're always fainting at each other. And the Russians in the 1880s put an advance party in a place called Murghab in Tajikistan. And the British had parties stationed in Chitral and Gilgit in northern Pakistan. And that was the closest they would ever get together. But in, I think it was 1892, France's young husband, aged about 20, who you will know of from his fine books at the time, aged about 25, was sent out to prospect what was going on and whether what the Russians were doing up there. And he went up through what is now northern Pakistan and entered the Vakhan corridor over one of the two or three possible passes there. And in a place called Bozai Gumbas, which one can think of as the center of the Vakhan, he met Captain Yanov, who was the captain in charge of the Russian party, who had a tent full of people and were claiming it to be, well, initially they welcomed each other as they knew each other from or knew of each other, and they dined together and they toasted the Tsar and Queen Victoria and then departed. And then he came back 2 days later, and Yanov said to him, "I'm afraid I have to tell you to leave Russian territory." And they were very polite to each other and hugged each other. And that was probably the only moment when Russians and British met during the Great Game.
It's such a legendary story. I mean, this is one of the interesting things about that whole time period. The politeness and mutual respect between these great travelers, but at the same time, they're maneuvering behind each other's back and everybody's kind of scheming to map this territory.
Yeah, exactly. So then a few years later, George Nathaniel Curzon, later to be Viceroy of India, who had been already a sort of very junior member of the minister in Lord Salisbury's government, and then the Whigs won the I think it was the 1890 election or something like that. So he was out on his ear for a bit without much to do, and decided his way to advancement would be to travel around the world. And he'd done a series of remarkable journeys, and he then did this journey up through North Pakistan, through the beautiful Hunza Valley. I mean, a place that everybody should get a chance to go to, one of the most beautiful places in the world, which is on what we now call the KKH, the Karakoram Highway, which the Chinese have been rebuilding quite a lot recently under their program. He went up through Hunza, having spent a week or so as guest of the Mir of Hunza, and went further north and crossed into the Vakhan through, I think, a pass called the Ershad Pass, knowing that that he was going to get into this Vakhan corridor and would be close to where the Russians were. And he was with three or four other people. And when he did so, you come over this pass, and you come down into the Little Pamir, or into a part of the Little Pamir, a sort of junior part of the Little Pamir, at which point he hit a river just to the west of him. And instead of traveling down the river back towards the main part of Afghanistan. Instead of doing that, he turned upstream and travelled upstream until he arrived at a place that he called the Ice Cave, where this river was appearing fully formed out of three glaciers. And he drew pictures of the thing, measured it, and then followed it downstream, and decided what he had found was the source of the Great River Oxus. And the River Oxus had been, the source of the river had been a subject of great speculation for many years. There was a guy called John Wood, who in 1838 had travelled up the Oxus towards a lake called Siakul in Tajikistan, and he claimed that that was the source of the Oxus, and it certainly looked like it. It's a very big river at that stage. And then there were two Frenchmen and an Indian pundit called the Mirza, who claimed that the source of the Oxus was a lake called Chakmaitin in the Vakhan corridor itself. But Curzon came back. I mean, he was already quite a well-known man, and he was an extremely powerful speaker, presenter, and personality. And he returned to Great Britain, thrilled with himself, claiming that he'd found the source of the Great Oxus, which was politically important because there'd been a treaty between Britain and Russia in 1873, which suggested that the course of the Oxus from its source would be established as the frontier between the two groups. He returned to Britain, and instead of giving one of the famous Royal Geographical Society Monday lectures, he demanded that he gave three in a row. During his three in a row, he described how he had found the source of the Great River Oxus, and it seemed to be correct. Although young husband, a year or two later, when he went back, he had some questions about this. But for most of us, and indeed for the whole time from 1895 until certainly we went in 2008, the source of the Oxus was that ice cave. And I wanted to go to the ice cave because I had no record that anybody else had ever been there since. And it was, it had a sort of fairy tale type, it gave a fairy tale quite impression, because there it is, in what they call the Pamir Knot, which is where the five mountain ranges of Central Asia all meet in this jumble of mountains. Almost as far from the sea as anywhere else in the world can be. And he spoke of this ice cave with the water pouring out, and it just seemed like something we should go and have a look at. So we set off to try and find it.
Well, it's interesting that you point out that this, for the longest time, no one knew exactly where the river was. This is something that's emblematic of that whole period in the Great Game. So much of this region was unmapped at the time, like this frontier between Tsarist Russia and Imperial India. The reason that so many travelers were venturing into it was because there could be other passes that provide sort of a easy backdoor into India for any invading troops. I mean, the terrain is so rugged and was so unknown. And then you have in the stands, or what is today Uzbekistan in that region, some very unfriendly rulers who would kill travelers on site or any visitors coming there. So it was this crazy golden age of travel. And anybody who's read Rudyard Kipling's Kim will have glimpsed another aspect of the Great Game, where spies were disguised as holy men, you know, traveling through the mountains with trained to carefully count their steps in order to map the distance, and with, you know, hidden thermometers to calculate altitude, and scribbled notes hidden inside prayer wheels, that this idea of clandestinely mapping all these territories. So there was the combination of that sort of high adventure, the ability to get these trips, you know, sponsored by the government, basically, if you're acting in their interests, and the ego involved in discovery and claiming these places for oneself and rushing back to publish your records. So it was such a fascinating period from a travel perspective as well.
Yeah, the pundits were sent out into Tibet to with, as you say, their prayer beads, using them in effect as an abacus to count the steps. And there was one of these fellows who was sent out, I think, by the junior to the surveyor of India who gave his name to Everest. I can't recall his name, Mortimer, it may have been. And he sent him out. And then he came back and reported about the Tsangpo River flowing through southern Tibet, which they thought would eventually become the Brahmaputra. But they didn't know. And we know it does. It goes through the huge Tsangpo Gorge in above Assam. He was sent back. Said, "Okay, you're going to go back. You get there, and you are going to pour. You're going to paint 50 logs bright red, and we're going to send the people down into northern Assam, and we're going to wait to see how long it takes them to arrive." And it was 2 years later before he got back to Mortimer and said, "When did they arrive?" And he said, "We forgot to send the men out." So it wasn't actually until 1927, I think, that they finally established that the Tsangpo did indeed finally flow down through Assam.
It's strange, I think, for people to think about this who grew up in a world of satellite mapping and yes, you know, Google Earth and all these things, where some of these questions are now fairly easy to solve or reasonably easy to solve. So much of the world, even in the late 1800s, was still unmapped and unexplored. I'm sure there's still places in some of those regions that no one's set foot in. I mean, it's pretty rugged country. So you've said that you couldn't find any record of anybody going back to check out this ice cave physically in person. Since Curzon. So why was the Wakhan Corridor out of reach for much of the 20th century?
Well, that end of the, I mean, I think the only people who probably, I'm sure there were Vaki shepherds and things who'd been up there, or people chasing a Marco Polo sheep or something or other had been up there. But the only people who would have really been interested in exploring that particular bit of the cul-de-sac would have been people like you and I who'd read Curzon and thought, this is an exciting place to go. Let's find out about it. There was a guy from the Aga Khan Foundation who'd been up very close to it. And I met him in Kyrgyz, in Bishkek, actually, on my way. So we were excited by it, and I wanted to go and have a look, say, well, it's interesting, over the last 100 years, what's happened to this ice cave? Does it still exist? And in fact, when we finally got to the ice cave, we'd hired people from Badakhshan in Afghanistan as guides, but none of them had been there before. But it wasn't difficult. It wasn't like it was a problem to find it, because we were just following the river. But when we got there, we found it was pretty much, and we measured it pretty much as it had been in 1895, and so that was exciting. But the we then found that I suspected that it may be Curzon was wrong, and it wasn't the source of the river, because of something that I'd found on some Russian military maps when planning the journey.
So where did you find these maps?
I think I found them at Stanford, because the Russians, remember, the Russians have been in Afghanistan for 10 years after the 1979 invasion, and they'd mapped almost the whole area, and they'd done some sort of survey of the Wakhan, and there were signs that Russians had been in the upper Wakhan. And these maps seem to show that it was possible that there was another source, another real source for the Oxus, because Curzon had presented four possible sources for the Oxus and then claimed that his was much the biggest, and the source of a river, which is of no great consequence. I mean, as Curzon himself said, it is no more significance than a county bylaw, but it's fun for people to find out. He had claimed that the way you find the source is always to follow the biggest contributory at any intersection point. And he established that the biggest contributory eventually led to the ice cave. Well, what we found was that there was a possibility that he was wrong, because there was a possibility that two of the other three potential sources were actually the same. And we then discovered that was true. We went back into the Vakhan, up into the little Pamir, to this beautiful lake, Lake Chakmaktin, which takes a large part of the eastern end of the little Pamir. And there, then Lake Chakmaktin is the source of a river called the Murghab River, which goes north into Tajikistan, crosses all of Tajikistan, and meets the Oxus Panj, as they call it, at Roshan Vomar, and is arguably as big as the Oxus Panj itself. So that was clearly a possible source for the Oxus. But what we discovered was that the Chakmaktin Lake was fed by a little stream called the Chelab Stream, or reasonable sized stream called the Chelab Stream, which does a remarkable thing. It comes down out of the mountains between Tajikistan and the Vakhan. And when it comes down, it hits the flat little Pamir, which is like a watershed, and it can't decide which way to go. And half of it goes into Lake Chakmaktin, and the other half feeds itself into Curzon's own river coming down from the ice cave. So in effect, that watershed creates something which means that the Chelab stream is actually feeding two of the possible sources of the Oxus and making them into one. So our conclusion was, if that's the case, then there is no doubt that the Chelab stream is the real source of the Oxus. And the fun thing is that, as far as I know, no one has followed. I think it's now accepted that the Chelab stream is. I think if you look on Wikipedia, you'll find they accept that that is the real source of the Oxus. But as far as I know, no one has yet travelled up that Chelab stream. And it's only probably about a 5 or 6 hour hike up it to plonk a little sign and say, this is the source of the Oxus, Panj, Amu Darya, Murghab rivers.
So when deciding what's the source of a river, is it the site of the largest volume, or is it the furthest point that feeds into it that's more important?
Well, you go up the river, and when you come to a tributary or contributory, you choose the biggest at that point.
So it has to be the biggest. It doesn't have to just be the one that's furthest away from the end of the river.
Oh, sorry, the ones that's carrying the biggest volume. Yeah. And which, of course, changes with the season. So you follow that, find the next contributory, follow that one, and eventually get to the source, which is what they. I mean, in the case of the Nile, for example, what you would probably do is come out of Lake Victoria and see which the biggest river coming out of the Ruwenzori Mountains is, and that would be the real source of the Nile. Although one, I was taken into the middle of Lake Victoria by a guy with a tiny little boat, and he found this boiling stream in the middle, and he said, "Here is the source of the Nile."
I don't think anybody's going to trace that one. That would Rukar Gills, perhaps. Yeah. So this place, it's for much of the 20th century, it was cut off. I mean, it was a Soviet buffer zone, but the Afghan War, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and then the conflicts that came after with the Americans and the Taliban and all these things made this quite a difficult place to get to. What was the greatest challenge that you found when it came to reaching this place, this remote place?
The While the Russians were there, no, there was no access, and the Pakistanis, they make certain that it's closed both ways. And I mean, they are already pretty excited. They see the Vakhan corridor as rather a romantic place to be as well. But so during Russian times, it was no good. It became after 2003. It was sort of no one was going to stop you going in. So there was no political. So we actually entered via a place called Ishkashim in Tajikistan, rather than via Kabul, and then coming up through the through what could have been some difficult areas. The most difficult thing for me is that I'm very bad on heights, so I did not like being. What happens with the Vakhan is the long first part is following what has become the Pan-Jocsis, with mixing the two or three sources together. The first part of the journey, then you reach a barrier where the Vakhan massif starts at a place called Sarhad, where there is a village, and we gathered a couple of people to help us. And then you have to climb the Vakhan massif, so you're climbing from about 1,000 meters to 3,500 meters or something like that. So for me, the acrophobe, it was climbing up there, but we were able to bring a couple of horses along who struggled through. So that was useful for pack carrying. After that, you're on the flat. It's wonderful. It's marvelous. It's very, very cold at night. It snows at night. And in the daytime, it's 110 degrees or something. But beautiful. Beautiful. I mean, you're looking at these glorious upland pastures that you don't see maybe anywhere else in the world. There is a sort of Pamir in North Pakistan called the Deosai Plains. So that's the sort of place I would love to go sometime, which is another very high altitude plain. But you've got flowers. It's herbs rather than grasses. In the summer, when we were there in July, I think, there are Vaki tribesmen living in tents there and moving their tents all the time when they need to move for the pasture, and then they go down in the winter.
Are these like Mongol tents, something similar?
Very similar. I mean, yeah, those Kyrgyz, the movable Kyrgyz type tents, the same things you'll see up in Mongolia, in Tajikistan, in Kyrgyzstan.
So is the Chinese end open?
Well, it is not open. There is a barrier where you could get down, and you would get eventually come down into a place called Tashkurgan, because if you cross the end of the Karakoram Highway in North Pakistan is a place called the Kunjarab Pass, which is a marvelous place to be. I was there in 1988, and you get to the top and you look out. It seems like you've got all of Asia in front of you. You can see the Himalayas to the right. You're in the Karakorams. You can see all of. You're looking down into Xinjiang, and you cross, and you can just see a defile into what you think is the Vakhan up to the left. And you see the Tian Shan Mountains in front of you, Hindu Kush to your left. You really feel like you're in the center of the world there. First place you get to is a sort of old fort called Tashkurgan, which is at the Chinese end of the Vakhan, but there isn't really. I mean, they say that Marco Polo went through there, and they're talking about building a road through there to get into China under the Belt and Road Initiative. Who knows?
Well, but why would they? What would be the advantage of that?
Well, there's a big advantage for China in having access at the south western end, which is an access separate from the Karakoram Highway. Otherwise, but there was also a lot of nervousness about the relations between the Uyghur in Xinjiang and the other Islamic peoples in the stands area.
Yeah, you would think
So
that would facilitate contact, which would make them nervous.
But they'd have to do something somehow. They'd have to build that road so that it comes down through the Vakhan Massif, which I think is going to be quite an effort for them.
I saw just a corner of that bit of China, down more along that. We didn't get as far as where the Wakhan meets China, more around Tajikistan, but down from Kashgar, we followed the highway to, I think it was called Karakul Lake. But I mean, there's a lot of Karakul lakes in that region. There's more than one.
So you were in Kashgar,
Yeah.
and then you followed and you went south from Kashgar.
Yeah, along that same highway, but just as far
Because
as
you,
just.
when you do that, you come on your to the east of you, you'll find those two marvelous mountains, the
Yes.
Kongor and Mustagata,
Exactly, right around
sitting
there.
on their own, beautiful mountains. I mean, you don't often see two. I suppose they're 7,500 meter mountains, aren't they? Pretty much on their own.
Yes, yeah, covered in
Not
snow.
many places in the world where you can see that.
Yeah, that's exactly where we camped, right around that area. Just trying to get a taste of it. I mean, our objective was the Taklamakan. So we were planning to circle from Kashgar down around the south end of the desert towards Khotan and then go into the desert by camel. But so this was just sort of a side trip to get a glimpse of this region, but it wasn't kind of the main objective of
So did you do that then?
the Taklamakan, yeah.
So you went down through past those mountains, then you turned eastwards.
So went back to Kashgar and then went from
Oh, you went
there.
back to Kashgar.
Well, went from there to Yarkand and then
Yarkand, yep.
Khotan. I think it was in we were looking for people who owned camels, some herdsmen that would be willing to take us out into the desert. It was a Canadian that I met in a bar in Kashgar and myself who were both interested in deserts. So I think it was in Yarkand we heard about some guys further down the road. And maybe got a contact from somebody. This is 20 years ago. And then we ended up in Khotan, met up with these camel herders whose family and whose father knew the desert well, who would own camels, these two brothers. And they took us out into the sands for about a week. And I mean, you've seen the Taklamakan, I'm sure it's just nothing but sand dunes, disorienting sand dunes. But we rode up along the Khotan River where it goes into kind of peters out in the desert where Sven Hayden kind of crawled out on his last legs to find water. And then we turned east from there and kind of made a big loop back down to a village on the edge of the desert.
Well, that's a wonderful journey to have done. I'd love to do that journey. You were in the Yarkand.
That was my first magazine feature. I ended up selling that after I got back from that trip to a Canadian magazine that I went on to write for quite a number of years.
Did you establish whether Alexander Burns, who became known as Bokhara Burns in the 1860s, who travelled through Kabul and then crossed the Oxus and got to Bokhara, which was I mean, that was a place of great mystery for the Victorian era. He went to Yarkand and he discovered they had a thing called temporary marriages. He was encouraging everybody to go and take advantage of temporary marriages in Yarkand.
Are the sorts of stories that would best remain unpublished at this point. At least for my marriage. But no, I didn't encounter any temporary marriages at that time. A lot of Chinese military presence. That was the thing that stood out in my mind. There were massive bases out there,
Yeah.
just in the center of nowhere.
Yeah, and
And
it must be much, much, much worse. I mean, I experienced how unpleasant, I'm sorry to say, the Han Chinese were to the Uyghur when I was there in 1988, and then again a few years later. And I mean, now it is far, far worse than that.
I think it's a high-tech prison state now, and at the time, even in 2002, it was pretty awful to see. That's gotten much worse. So we should go back to the Wakhan there. I wanted to ask you also how you supplied this trip. Like how were you supplied? And you mentioned that there were herdsmen living up in the you encountered different herdsmen. Were you able to purchase food from them? And I.
Yeah, we could purchase sheep from there. So a sheep did us for a week. We had a guy. I had a an Ismaili Hazari from Faizabad and an Uzbek, who I think also came from Faizabad, who spoke a tiny bit of English. or the old word, and an older guy who came from Ishkashim, and a wonderful fellow who actually came from the lower Vachan, who was helping me when I was in trouble on the heights and things, and did the whole journey in sort of beaten up Wellington boots, and then introduced me to his wonderful mother when we came back down. And they brought a certain amount of food with them, because we were 3 weeks up there, and then we bought a couple of sheep, so that was fine, and so we had no problem for food at all.
The guys that you hired along the way, I mean, you mentioned that none of them had ever been up that far into this territory. What did they think of it?
Well, they hadn't. I mean, they knew the place existed, but I suppose they had no particular reason to go up there. There was a guy, the one porter guide. Who stayed with us the whole way through. We left some of them in the main Pamir bit when we went for the final push up to find the ice cave. And we brought one guy with us who claimed he knew everything. He was called the Mirsa in my book. You'll see pictures of him with these wonderful hats. And he claimed he knew the area. And he was brilliant because he was able, and I've got pictures of him doing it, to get into the river and catch the trout with his hands. First of all, he caught the trout in his trousers, tied the end of his trousers together, and then chased them into his trousers. And then he went and what I think they called pickling them and brought them out, thrilled with himself. I mean, they thought it was an interesting place to go, but why were we mad enough to want to do so, really?
You mentioned earlier to me that there was a possibility of an expedition going back out to verify your findings on the oxus, but that COVID had derailed it.
It would be fun. That's right. I think it was people at Oxford University had planned to do this thing. COVID derailed it. So it's still open.
So they never talked about bringing this back up again, or just finished the plan?
I don't know. No, there was a guy called Matthew Leeming who was setting it up, and I haven't heard from him for a while. He was writing for The Spectator, I think. But somebody should do it. And you go into Afghanistan, probably still through Ishkashim, and then gather yourselves, people to look after you, go up the up into the Vachan, and when you get to Lake Chakmak, Maktin, you take that Chelab up towards the Tajik border. It would be fun to do so.
So any advice for travelers who want to see the Wakhan corridor for themselves? More general advice, not non-expeditionary travelers, but just adventurous travelers?
I think people, quite a few are going up there. They can do it. It takes quite a bit of time. You can't enter through Pakistan, because the borders there remain closed, but you can get up into the Vachan. My recommendation is to do so. Yes.
It sounds like an amazing trip. So I thought, okay, well, thank you for your time today, Bill. This is a corner of the world I've been curious about for at least 20 years since I caught a glimpse of that region in China and after reading Peter Hopkirk. So I'd love to see it, and I really enjoyed seeing it through your eyes.
Well, I think it is you and I both. We hear about places and somehow feel one has to go there, and then you feel it's sort of your own.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Personal Landscapes. If you like the podcast, please give it a rating on iTunes and subscribe through your favorite app. You can find links to today's podcast and more conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdock.com. You'll also find a donate button if you'd like to contribute to the costs of the show. All donations are greatly appreciated.